WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm just a
Hello, my special radio friends, and welcome to yet another instance of the radio show Sex Talk, also known as Love Line. This is WRCT Pittsburgh, and here with me tonight in the studio is Michael. Michael is a long-standing member of the campus community and a founder of one of its preeminent pro-sex religious sects on campus, the what is it called? Michael?
First Church of Christ Abortionist.
First Church of Christ Abortionist.
We believe that Jesus was an abortionist.
And we'll get to that. And thank you for joining us. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And welcome, Michael.
Glad to be here.
Now, Michael, I understand that you are a longtime sexual person and sexual activist, and as well as an objectivist. But I was recently shocked to discover that in your personal life, you've actually eschewed any kind of sexual activity. You've become you've become celibate in your personal life, even though you have a very radical pro-sex stance.
Well, I think I need to make two corrections here. One is that I am not an objectivist. The objectivist, for people who don't know, is a follower of Ayn Rand, kind of this.
Ayn Rand is this kind of 1950s screenwriter slash philosopher.
Yeah, she kind of formed this cult of individualists who all think the same. It's an amazing concept. But actually, I do share Ayn Rand's view of sex, which is kind of interesting in a way.
Which is what, that sex is a transaction and there's a monetary cost that can be applied to any sexual act?
Well, that would be consistent with the other things Rand said, is to believe that. But she actually had this view of sex being romantic, and even the heroes and heroines of her story, recognize each other by, just by looking at each other, and they know that they both, have this, noble set of ideals.
Well, I find that very interesting. I mean, I wonder if there's a parallel between this, if this trait that you mentioned in Ayn Rand's novel is a kind of gaydar, if you will, in the same way that gay men are able to sort of tell that other men are gay just by doing it. Can John Galt have a kind of Galtdar, if you will?
Well, people give out a lot of clues. I have a kind of interesting story with this, because I was thinking about this, because you and I have talked about this issue before, and like one of the times where it really struck me that someone was gay is, when I was young and more emotionally turbulent and all this type of stuff, I was talking to this woman, and, she was like, being motherly, as sometimes when, teenage boys talk to women, they'll be motherly.
So this was an older woman?
Yeah, she was about 32 or 33. She died three months later in a car wreck, which is sad. But
that's really tragic. So in some sense, you were the Nathaniel Brandon to her Ayn Rand.
Well, no. Well, it wasn't that. It wasn't sex. It was that I was hugging this woman, and it occurred to me just like overwhelmingly as I was hugging this woman, as she was hugging me back, that this woman was a lesbian. And so it was gaydar, but it was not some sexually motivated gaydar. It was simply just this realization of who she was that happens at times. One just understands these things intuitively.
And this information was transmitted from her to you via the hug?
I mean, that's when it came together in my mind, that the kind of the entire gestalt of it just kind of like all fit together.
So, that's fantastic. So it wasn't because she was wearing sandals or some kind of plaid shirt or.
Oh, she probably did wear a plaid shirt. I mean, she wasn't like
Or what, flannel shirt. I guess what's the standard
flannel
lesbian garb?
Uh huh.
And so then you yourself are a gay man, right? Or at least you've gone through gay phases, as I have.
Mm-hmm.
So do you currently self-identify as a homosexual?
I do.
Interesting. So getting back to this this vow of, well, or, I'm sorry. We can either get back to this vow of celibacy that you're talking about, or you can tell me about this.
It's not a vow of celibacy. It's more that I just haven't found very many conditions under which I'm willing to have sex. I mean, it's more a matter of refusal to have sex once, you know, this kind of like long list of conditions is met, and so I just don't have sex.
Well, so I find that really surprising, because many of our guests, especially on most on our recent shows, have a very kind of pro-recreation kind of attitude, like have sex with whomever you want, you know, and not make such a big deal about it. What are these restrictions on sex that you put? I mean, this is a very different point of view from our recent guests.
I basically want to be in love with someone first before I have sex.
Really?
Yes. And me being in love with someone, you know, I have, like, I guess you might say rather high standards. Maybe you could even say I've priced myself out of the romance market. I'm not sure.
Right. Well, you know, in the objectivist sense, going back to the objectivist, in any sexual act between two people is a transaction, if you will. So you are just setting your transaction price, if you will, a little higher than the average person, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so now it's well known on campus that you actually have had an affair with several members of this show's staff. Isn't that true? Several of our co-hosts have had some kind of...
I've had sex with one of your co-hosts.
Oh, with just one. Interesting. So were you in love at that time?
Yes, I was.
Interesting. Well, that's incredible. I've actually had, Juan and I have a very special relationship too, but he's not here tonight to talk about that, so that's too bad.
A very special relationship.
So this co-host, this unnamed Loveline sex talk co-host that you're involved with.
Well, I'm actually planning to refer to him by the name Chris, which is in fact his name. So
that's not a pseudonym for Christ, referring to the on-campus ministry that you started.
No.
Okay. So Chris. So Chris, or anybody else, if you're out there and listening, please do call in. The phone numbers, as always, are 268 WRCT and 621 WRCT. And don't forget to check out our website, which is always at http://loveline.wrct.com. So tell me a little bit about this campus ministry of yours. Is this still active?
Well, I had a picnic on Sunday.
A picnic?
Yes, we had a picnic. It was we called it Bring Out Your Dead Day. And, you know, I made kind of this couscous-type grain, and then I made some vegetable dish to go on top of it. It worked out pretty well. We had about 7 people come.
Really? Mm-hmm. So these are all campus abortionists or campus Christians? Or?
Well, actually, they were just my friends. I don't think anyone actually came because it was the First Church of Christ abortionist picnic. But, you know, it goes like that. You know, it's really hard to lead people into the ways of the Lord.
Now, didn't you really start this group as a joke or as some kind of political statement, just to see if you could get funding for the most outrageous group you could think of? Or do you really believe that Jesus Christ was the first abortionist?
Well, the First Church of Christ abortionist has never claimed Jesus was the first abortionist.
Oh, I see.
Because,
I'm sorry if I can cut the doctrine.
I mean, it'd be like claiming that, you know, he was the first carpenter also. I mean, abortion and infanticide have been practiced, you know, before the human race actually became the human race. That we are a species that is infanticidal. And that's a good thing. You know, I think infanticide gets condemned far too harshly. It's actually a good thing. It's just that we now have a better technology called abortion, and so, you know, we should use it instead. And our theory is that Jesus, you know, because he's concerned about people and wanted to increase their freedom, you know, that he you know, helped them by being an abortionist back in ancient Israel. And, you know, there's several things he says that indicates this, you know.
So there are comments in the New Testament specifically related to abortion?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you know any of them offhand?
Well, let's see, what is it? Mark 7:17, I think. Woe unto those who are pregnant and nursing babies in those times. That's one. And
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have the source material here, and so I can't look up these quotes. But indeed, this is very fascinating. There was, do you So is this still an active group? Do you still get hate mail and death threats and so on?
We still get some hate mail. We haven't really been pushing it too much recently. You know, I think our last statement was, you know, was an attack on Mother Teresa when she died, you know.
It's interesting. You and the Objectivists share a hatred for Mother Teresa.
Well, I think part of it is, you know, about the Objectivists is that, I mean, they are, you know, pretty dogmatic atheists, and, you know, and sometimes, you know, I feel that way also, you know, when I, you know, lack the faith of our Lord the abortionist. And so, you know, I guess it's only to be natural that, you know, since we share, you know, common enemies, like the evil Catholic Church, that, you know, we'd sound the same some of the time. I think it's even more amazing that Rand and I have kind of similar views about sex when you come right down to it.
Really? So what are Rand's, and by extension, what are your views on sex? If you could expound on that a little bit.
I think this is the way Rand puts it. This is not the way I would put it, but this is the way Rand puts it. You look for, you know, like your highest values in your sexual partner, and, you know, you're looking for like this nobility and to be uplifted. I think that's a little bit stilted way of viewing the world, like most of what Rand has to say. But I would say that, you know, that you're really looking for someone, or at least I'm really looking for someone who I can enjoy laughing with. I think that's ultimately the thing, that, you know, someone that's fun for me to be around, someone that I'm happy to be around. Someone that, you know, I can feel like a 13-year-old girl with, basically. I think this is really the key.
So Ayn Rand was actually strictly opposed to the idea of fun, was she not? Or at least fun in the absence of financial incentive.
She wasn't a very joyful person. So it is a little bit hard to explain her views completely about sex. I mean, you know, but she was willing to, you know, have a husband, Frank O'Connor, and then take on a 20-year-old lover when she was 49 years old.
This would be the aforementioned Nathaniel Brandon.
Right. And I think that's cool. I mean, I think that's a pretty reasonable thing for her to do. She can get away with it, you know. I mean, it was a pretty radical step for a woman in the 1950s to do something like that. It'd be a pretty radical step now.
But even more exciting, when he no longer pleased her, she not only rejected him from her bed, but shunned him from her organization. Isn't that right?
He became unclean in the eyes of the Objectivist movement.
So I think your attitude about love is actually very, it's very sweet and very traditional. We should all strive to be like a 13-year-old girl. I mean, I think that is actually the...
Well, I guess the other aspect of it, to some extent, is that I actually really do think that, on the whole, we should encourage people to... to seek more in their, you know, relationships with others, that to a large extent, you know, that maybe this is my own needs, but I actually think it's for most of our needs that what we really need is emotional intimacy. That this is what, in some sense, makes people happy, and that, you know, that we have, you know, we have to work and we have to sleep, and so we have a limited time to like satisfy our needs. And it seems that the first needs that we should be striving to meet are our needs for emotional intimacy as opposed to, you know, our needs for sex. And, by the way, can I say the F word?
Or it depends on which F word you mean. If you mean the traditional F word, I think the answer is no.
Okay. I was just wondering what the rules were.
You can say friend and freak.
Oh, okay. So I won't use the F word.
You can say Dominique Francone, or in fact, any of the Objectivist character names are completely allowed, except for Ellsworth Toohey, because we don't agree with his principles. None of the Objectivist anti-heroes may be mentioned, but
you know, change the topic. I actually tried to read The Fountainhead, which is another F word. And I just found myself, like, just completely despising and being completely unable to relate to the characters in it. I mean, it just was like, they were like, I mean, in some sense, you know, this one character, Howard Rourke.
That's right.
He's like, you know, exactly what I'm saying is the problem with promiscuity to a large extent is that, you know, he had no connection with other people. But, you know, he was like, you know, just off in his own bizarre little world. And that in some sense, like, I've long felt that having, you know, like 500, 600 sexual partners in a year or something like that, which is, you know, feat of some gay men have achieved, this is the ultimate expression of libertarianism applied to a sex life. And, you know, we're, you know, in some sense, we're never going to value any other human being. You just, you know, they're just kind of these interchangeable body parts. And I think that in some sense, when people do this, that there is a slight embittering of the person. They do become like this hard work person.
But that's actually very interesting. So you, in some sense, you might say Howard Rourke was the ultimate promiscuous gay club-going. Well, I mean, for example, in The Fountainhead, there is a scene where Howard Rourke rapes Dominique Francone, is that right?
Yeah.
So, using her, I guess, for his own sexual pleasure. I mean, is this the kind of thing you're talking about?
I'm more thinking about how he was so really detached from the people he was with that he really couldn't really care less about any of the other characters in the novel, that he was like, there's like no emotional warmth in this person at all. It's like, like he was not a member of the human species, which humans are a social species, but some species which is not human. And ultimately, it would seem, you know, once you get to a species completely solitary, it'd be like non-reproductive. So I'm not really sure, like, what would be a good example of a species Howard Rourke could be a member of, you know?
So it's interesting, because you're actually turning out to be sort of more of a traditionalist than I expected. I mean, I had thought earlier, I had the impression that you were kind of a campus radical in terms of sex, you know, advocating all kinds of sex so long as it's non-reproductive.
I think sex is best when it's non-reproductive.
But now you're talking about a very traditional point of view that a lot of your opponents would actually agree with. You know, don't have sex unless you're in love with someone.
Right. I'm kind of aware of that. I think that what I'm trying to advocate, in a way, I think is a moderate position between, like, promiscuity and monogamy. That I'm saying, you know, that, you know, I'm certainly not saying go live as husband and wife forever and never get divorced or something like that. I'm saying, you know, be in love with people. And I think that part of that is you also have to be willing to try to love other people, too, because it does take some effort to do this. And in this sense, you know, if you're willing to, in some sense, risk some emotional commitment to other people, you develop yourself into a more interesting person and maybe into a happier person.
So tell me about some of your more recent experiences. I understand this spring and earlier you were actually falling in love with someone who's no longer here on campus.
Yeah, he's left Pittsburgh.
So this was a man.
Yes.
And so tell me a little bit about that. How did this come about?
Well, I was in the locker room, and this guy and I shared where I was in, like, the same aisle, and so we talked to each other a little bit.
So tell me about the moment of the first meeting. Did you when you first saw each other, did you sense that you were both objectivists?
I sensed that he was someone who would like me. Yes, from my first moment. Yeah.
So you're in the locker room. You're taking off your. And this sounds like the beginning of a porn movie, right? You're taking off your jock straps.
Uh-huh.
He's commenting on your abs, say.
Uh-huh.
You look into his eyes, and
well, I first met him when I was still dating Chris here.
Chris, the co-host.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I thought he was someone I'd like, but we never really did anything much. I mean, you know, I just kind of talked to him once in a while. And then just before Christmas, you know, I made the Christmas of 97,
mm-hmm.
so it's not that long ago. I made the comment to him, you know, he said, well, why are we always in the same aisle? I said, because, you know, we're searching for some stability in our lives because neither of us have it any other way. And he broke up laughing at that. And he said, well, you know, we really have to go out and get a beer sometime.
Interesting.
And then I come back in January, and he sees me, and he says, well, let's go out for the beer, and then we're going to do it Friday night. And then it comes Friday night, and he says, well, let's not do that. Let's go out and eat at a nice restaurant. And he says, well, let's meet at this place. And, when I go to the place we're supposed to meet at, he kind of manages to run at me in a way that's slightly, you know, suggesting kind of eroticism and kind of the physical play that's going on. And so we go to the restaurant. He says, well, let's get some wine. And so we get some wine and we, you know, eat at this restaurant. And it's this all very, like, you know, kind of this recipe to get someone to fall in love with you.
So I find this story completely incomprehensible in the sense that...
Oh, it gets worse.
So is this man gay? I mean, is this sort of a gay comment? I mean, how can someone be this forward? And what did you know about each other that would make him comfortable being this openly suggestive to you? I mean, I never ask anybody out in the locker room, although, you know, I've been tempted to.
Well, actually, I did it on Sunday. There's this really hot guy I met in the whirlpool.
Oh, are you serious?
I'm quite serious. His name, by the way, is really funny. His name is Hung. I met him in the whirlpool.
His name is Hung? Wow, so indeed, is he one of these people that encodes their own kind of self-description, or is this...
He seemed pretty average size, but...
Interesting.
But, and I invited him to the picnic I had on Sunday, and he came.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But anyhow, that's another story. But anyhow, but it wasn't just that. I mean, after we do our various exercises and whatnot, Ashraf would he'd play squash and I'd swim or something, or I'd go lift weights, and he'd want to make sure that we would go into the whirlpool together, and you know, we'd go into the whirlpool and we'd kind of like play with each other a little bit.
Also, play? What do you mean play? Hold on here, play?
Well, we'd tickle each other, splash each other, and stuff like that. No, we didn't
really
touch genitalia, but like he'd do things like he'd like go under, you know, put his head underwater for some time, and I'd start tickling him to see, you know, if he.
This is making me a little bit queasy with all this overt sexuality in the locker room.
Well, actually, it made. Someone one time came in while we were like, well, I had him like kind of pinned up against the side of the whirlpool, and I kind of felt uncomfortable myself.
Yeah, no doubt. So are you both nude in the whirlpool while you're doing
this
frolicking?
Yes.
That's so I don't know. That's like the Greek ideal of of perfect love, right? I mean, these two muscular youths frolicking in the baths, or do I mean objectivist? I mean, there was a, wasn't there a scene in I forget which novel where John Galt and Howard Rourke finally meet, and they That would actually be a perfect piece of internet slash fiction. I think I'll have to write this. John Galt and the Howard Roark finally meet, and obviously they're the only person good enough for each other because, you know, everyone else doesn't quite measure up.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine the steamy dialogue. It's like, John, you know, your buildings are so clean and powerful.
I would point out Rand was anti-gay.
Rand was anti-gay?
Yeah.
Now, how is that possible?
Because it just, you know, it didn't suit her morals, you know. I mean, you know, best not to try to understand this woman, is my opinion. But,
By the way, if you want to learn more about Ayn Rand, please look up her website, which is at www.aynrand, that's spelled AYNRAND.org.
That's true. And so anyhow, when I went over to his house one night, he managed to, you know, not tell me, like, when the final bus left from his house. I had to stay over at his house.
Really?
And so I had to, I demanded the bed, and so he had to sleep on the floor.
You demanded the bed?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so, before he goes to sleep, he comes over beside the bed. He hikes up. He was wearing boxer shorts. He hikes up his boxer shorts and says, "Look at this nice leg muscle that Squash has given me."
Wow. And did you proceed to lick it?
No. I just kind of looked at him. And then he started, like, singing and dancing, "You can't have me. You can't have me." And then I got up out of bed, chased him into the next room, and pinned him up against the wall. And then you know what happened?
No, I don't.
Nothing.
Nothing.
All in all, kind of a disappointing story.
Well, it's left me in a state of advanced arousal. You're homosexual. You're gay,
right?
If you will. Was he gay, or was it some kind of?
He claimed he was straight.
And so, what was it? Some sort of exploratory college boy period, or what? What would motivate someone to frolic with you? So,
well, he was a virgin.
Really?
And he's 28 years old.
Interesting.
And so.
So does that suggest that he sort of had not resolved his feelings about his sexuality yet, or this was just the way he relates to his close friends? In the bottom line, why don't I have friends like this?
I think you just have to, like, learn to recognize them by sight, because suddenly I'm very good at, like, picking out the people who are like this. Just like characters in Ayn Rand novels, you know, you can pick out the other objectivist.
Right, right. Oh, exactly. That's very interesting. So I wonder if you could formalize this.
For instance, Hung.
Hung.
Is, I think, very much like Ashraf.
Interesting. This is incredible. So I go to the gym a lot. I go there every day, and this never happens to me. So what am I doing? What am I doing wrong? No one's frolicking with me in the hot tub, for example.
Uh-huh.
You know, I go in there, pretty much do my business, shower, and then leave.
Uh-huh.
There's no interaction with strangers. Am I too bitter? Is that the problem? Do people fear me?
Well, a lot of people aren't particularly social. And in some sense, it's some type of... I've learned some way to pick out some sort of person that is for some reason responsive to the type of person I am. I'm not sure how.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I wonder if this is some sort of evolutionary drive, right? To find a compatible, as you were talking about earlier, you know, to find a compatible mate who complements your qualities. Although I suppose it's sort of a, in some sense, it's hopeless because it's a sort of a non-reproductive path.
Well, I guess the basic problem is that in some sense it doesn't particularly screen real well on the basis of sexual orientation, which is a real problem.
Right.
I'm not really sure how to resolve that.
By the way, I should remind our listeners that the numbers, as always, are 268-WRCT and 621-WRCT.
I mean, it's something that does bother me that, you know, I don't seem to meet, you know, very many gay men that, you know, seem like they would be someone I'd want to be in love with. I mean, all of them. And I think one of the things about Ashraf was is that, you know, he was very much fun to be with. He was like, you know, could come back at, you know, some of my statements with very witty things pretty quickly. I mean, you're witty in your former gay phases and all that.
Thank you. I'm trying to suppress my wit in order to move to the next level of my objectivist training.
You know, I think we both have problems with Rand. You know, I think that's true. But, you know, there are other groups of people that we have problems with. There's another issue I want to talk about tonight.
Oh, by all means.
And it's basically,
I see you brought some material with you.
I did indeed. I'm basically a Nietzschean. You know,
You're a Nietzschean?
Yeah, I'm okay. A big fan of Friedrich Nietzsche. I mean, not you know, this is not to say a Nietzschean is not a randroid, because in some sense Nietzsche was very careful not to give people too much direction about what to believe, because
right.
he didn't want to form a cult. But to a large extent, he succeeded in not forming a cult, which doesn't say that one can't be a cult-like follower of Nietzsche, because one could become a cult-like follower of anything. I mean, it's a really wonderful thing about the human psyche. But and Nietzsche, you know, analyzed Christianity in terms of resentment. He said this is the basic Christian impulse. And
I'm sorry, just so I understand this, the basic Christian impulse is resentment?
Yeah.
All right.
I found a passage in a book which I thought really, really said what that Christian resentment is all about, and I think it's a really wonderful passage, and I want to read it to you. It's very short, so I'll actually read it twice.
Maybe we can put you on some kind of tape loop and have that sort of chanting in the background.
It's actually a very beautiful statement, a seductive statement even.
Written by Nietzsche.
No, this is by John D. Caputo. It's from his book, Against Ethics, Contributions to a Poetics of Obligation with a Constant Reference to Deconstruction. So this is someone who sounds like they're kind of on the left, just from the title of the book being this long.
They sound some kind of academic freak, but anyway.
Yeah, he's an academic philosopher at a Catholic university, which I think is pretty important. This is what he has to say. I am less alarmed over what is ugly than the power and prestige of what is beautiful. I'll read that one more time. I am less alarmed over what is ugly than the power and prestige of what is beautiful. I think that what's really going on here is that these people really are upset about, you know, beauty in the account in their life, because it sometimes does have a powerful influence on some people. And so to a large extent, what Christian values are often up to is the destruction of resentment. And this has a lot to do with, like, what underwrites, I think, a lot of Christian sexuality. And that even though, you know, in practice, I haven't had a lot of sex in some ways. In fact, I basically have had sex with Chris, the co-host of this show. It's my only sexual partner. It's not because I share any sense of Christian values, because in fact, I think Christian sexual values are written to avoid life being beautiful. That if you read what Paul wrote, you know, a lot of the New Testament, that he said, you know, man and women can have sex just so they won't commit any ugly sin somewhere else. And so they're trying to destroy sexuality as a beautiful thing. And that's what's underwriting Christianity and its forms of sexuality.
I mean, I'm unfortunately not a sort of an authority on Christianity, and so I can't really provide a powerful counterargument. But you can't possibly be right, right? I mean, surely the basic tenets of Christianity are more along the lines of, you know, mankind's kind of loftiest urges, you know, be good to people, sacrifice yourself for a greater cause,
and live
a life of dignity and respect and so on.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, if we're going to talk about Christianity straight out rather than just sexual ethics, I mean, well, think about what, you know, what do people think about when they think about Christianity? I mean, a lot of times, you know, we can see its political manifestations, you know, that we have groups of people that are, you know, deeply concerned that somewhere someone may have fun having sex. You know, this was true. Megan said this about the Puritans, and it's true about the Christian Coalition. I mean, you know, this is, you know, I mean, what these people are all about. You know, and what do they want? They want to, you know, stop the homosexual from enjoying his sex, or her sex life. They want to stop abortion because it's, you know, kind of God's punishment for you to get pregnant, and they're very specific that, you know, that if the child's really deformed, it'll be, you know, really, you know, horrible experience for the woman to have, you know, horrible situation for a family to live with, you know, a very deformed child. That they want to force people into these, you know, really ugly situations.
Well, so again, I'm afraid to go down this route because I don't want to be a defender of the Christian argument. But I think it's possible that you're sort of overstating the case. I do have a couple questions, if I just may. Why is it that anti-abortion and anti-homosexuality always come in the same package? Why are these two political agendas always tied together?
Well, I'm a chain on the whole. I mean, there's always, you know, people have their hooks to sell things, like you know, like Christianity. I mean, like, you know, we have an animal rights movement that's, you know, that's kind of opposed to cruelty, and, you know, you can have like this personification, which is false, of the fetus. You know, it suffers during an abortion, which clearly is nonsense in most abortions, because, you know, most abortions before the first trimester, right, and there's just nothing there that could possibly feel pain.
Right, the brain cells don't develop right away. I mean, that's pretty well established.
So, what's really underlying abortion is a concept of sexuality. That, you know, that to a large extent that we, you know, we're trying to keep, you know, the women in line, the women from having sex by forcing her to bear a child if she happens to get pregnant. I mean, it's really no different than female mutilation in Africa. I mean, it's the same concept, you know, of trying to, you know, stopping the woman from enjoying sex, because if she's worried about getting pregnant, you know, she's going to enjoy the sex less, and it's going to be, you know, a bad situation all in all.
But surely you're painting the whole group of Christianity with a pretty wide brush. I mean, I think the more enlightened Christians are probably indeed pro. I mean, I certainly know personal examples of people who are anti-abortion yet tolerant or.
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of things that go on, and ideas are spread in a variety of ways in the mass public. I mean, certainly there are Christian denominations that are pro-choice. You know, we come right down to it. I mean, like, it's very hard to imagine, like, getting a lot of Episcopalians, like, in a pro-life rally, you know. I mean, I'm not saying you can't find some, but, you know, you're not going to find a whole lot. I mean, it's not like Episcopalianism just isn't the type of religion that's, like, going to spread pro-life sentiments right and left. And you do get some variety, and, you know, some people actually, you know, because anything that's repeated often enough, people are going to believe. And if people repeat often enough, abortion is murder, you know, some people are going to believe this. And this is actually a very deep concern of mine, because I think that sometimes women feel guilty about having abortions. And I think this is the major contribution of a lot of this pro-life rhetoric, is women feeling useless guilt. I remember when I was like 13 or 14, I hadn't realized that masturbation was okay. I felt guilty about it. And I see, like, women today suffering the same way, you know, because, you know, they're just told they should feel guilty about abortion. And there's no reason you should feel guilty about abortion, any more than I felt guilty, I should have felt guilty about masturbation as a child. And, so, I really feel that this is an important message to get out to women, because, you know what, feminists aren't telling women this.
So am I dreaming, or did you just draw an analogy between abortion and masturbation?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Well, it's the same thing. It's the same useless guilt. I mean, it's like, and no one's telling women this. I mean, no one is telling women, don't feel guilty after having an abortion. And I think this is a very bad thing.
I mean, you can't possibly argue that this guilt is from external societal influences.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, just like, I mean, let's talk about this for a second. People felt immense, I mean, I felt guilt about masturbation as a child. A lot of people have trouble dealing with their homosexuality. There's nothing wrong with masturbation. There's nothing wrong with homosexuality. And there's nothing wrong with abortion. I mean, it's just, you know, that people, you know, are told they should feel guilt, and so they do. And so, you know, I see a very important message here that, you know, that we need to, you know, in some sense, help women who have abortions feel good about it. It's just something you did, and it's fine.
So, I would love to pursue this path further, but but you're so completely outrageous and frightening that I'm not even sure I'm.
How am I outrageous here? I think this is a very obvious thing I'm saying.
Come on. So masturbation is a sexual act. Homosexuality is a lifestyle. Both of which are kind of personal choices that are victimless, if you will. Whereas, you know, abortion.
There is no victim in abortion.
A national scourge, right?
There is no victim in abortion. Abortion is good for the woman because she's able to achieve her personal autonomy. It's good for our society and our environment because we live in an overpopulated world. Abortion is a great thing, and we need to stop like criticizing. This is the same thing that was, you know, in the Victorian England. It comes from the same source. It is an attack on women's sexuality. That is what the reason for this abortion thing. We have this abortion issue.
Okay, so I'm going to make a comment. Is this comment true, false, or irrelevant? That it would be desirable to replace most instances of abortion with better birth control and education?
Certainly, at the levels of abortion we have in the United States, it would be better to have less abortion and more birth control. But when we're talking about the levels of abortion that we have observe in Europe, I see no reason that we should reduce the abortion rate in Europe. I think it's absolutely fine level of abortion. The abortion rate in Europe is about 25% of what it is in the United States. You know? I think that's pretty fine. I mean, we can't expect a world of total control. I mean, you know, there are always going to be times where, you know, women are going to have unprotected sex and things will happen. And it shouldn't be viewed as a bad thing. It's just something that happens and you have an abortion about it. That's fine. You know, it's not like it should be thought of any worse than, you know, you happen to masturbate off into this handkerchief or something. You know, you go wash it, you go, you know, if you get the handkerchief, you go get an abortion because you have a conception. It's all fine.
So do you actually advocate infanticide post-birth?
Well, I think that there are tricky issues here because I don't object to infanticide in ancient cultures. Because I mean, I am not going to like condemn ancient Greece or 17th century Japan for practicing infanticide on a wide scale. I think the thing is that.
What about say modern China?
You know, I've really wondered if the state ordering infanticide for people who violate the one-child policy would be really that bad of a thing. I can actually see that that would not be unreasonable. I think on the whole, though, you really want to encourage people to kill fetuses as soon as possible. That's what respect for life is killing at the earliest possible moment. And that's why, in some sense, you really shouldn't have very many abortions past the first trimester, because they're really, except for if you have, except if you have some type of deformity, there's just no reason to, you know, be doing an abortion after 3 months.
I have a telepathic transmission from our producer, who I believe might have some commentary.
Yeah, actually, I just had a question for Michael about his sort of philosophy. Earlier in the show, you were saying, in terms of your own sexual philosophy and your choice not to have sex until you'd fallen in love with someone, that sort of this practice of promiscuity and having a lot of sexual partners was sort of a destructive path to follow in terms of personal isolation and other things. Do you think it's a little bit contradictory now that you're arguing that something like abortion should have no stigma associated with it? Because in some sense, it sort of encourages people to pursue a more promiscuous lifestyle with fewer consequences associated with it.
I think it's better if people decide not to have a promiscuous lifestyle just because they think it's the way they should be. Just as a side note, since Corey and I have been talking about this so much, I think it is interesting to note that Rand, who basically shares my views on sexuality, was also very rapidly pro-choice. I mean, so pro-choice that I really approve of her stance on abortion. And so I think that in some sense that Rand's in my view, and I hate to admit that I have this close of a view with this woman, but I think that they're pretty intimately related, because I think that to some extent that what Rand and I are trying to achieve in terms of sexuality is that people to have love without there being some worry about some outside motive. And having a child for both Rand and I would be a real catastrophe, because that would be the way we would feel about having a child we didn't want. And this is why, you know, a lot of feminists talk about abortion the way they do, because for a lot of women at certain points in their life, having a child would be, you know, like the worst thing that could happen to them.
So, I thought our producer had another question, but so, I'm sorry, I'm speechless for a moment here.
Yeah, I am too. Sorry.
You're flummoxed. Oh no.
Well, it didn't really. I don't think that really entirely addresses my question. But I'm sorry. What?
Oh, go ahead.
I don't know. I guess I just don't see that as the kind of person that really is out there having an abortion, really. I mean, we're talking about very, like, high-thinking, well-educated sort of, you know, the career academic sort of philosophy on life. I don't think necessarily applies across the board to society as a whole. It's some people think that clearly and comprehensively about their choices in life, and some don't.
Most don't, and I mean, in the United States, I mean, a lot of the problem is that there's really no effort to teach about sex education in any sane way, basically, and so children end up not using contraception when they do their first sexual acts. My suspicion is that a lot of the girls, and maybe this is because, you know, I went to school in, you know, rural high school in Western North Carolina. But, you know, a lot of the girls, when they first have sex, they really are in love with the guys they're having sex with. Maybe I'm naive, but that was what happened in my high school. And so I think some way the failure of them using birth control is more some way our refusing to educate them, and that we need to educate them, because, you know, if we can, you know, just by good sex education, the European you know, rate of illegitimacy is like a fourth of ours. No, I'm sorry, I'll take that. Rate of abortion is.
So can that abortion rate really be traced directly to their sex education as, in terms of cause and effect? Surely there must be other social factors.
Well, there are other social factors, and it varies from country to country too, so it's pretty tricky to talk about. I mean, in Sweden they have a welfare state that's very generous, and so a lot of they just have a lot of teenage pregnancy, like it's like they have in the United States. And actually, that would really take trying to figure out all that goes into it, it would be tricky. But I mean, I think in, you know, maybe, you know, like the Netherlands, that one could certainly say, you know, it's kind of like one of the European countries that's most closely culturally like us, but liberal. The sex ed is reducing the amount of unwanted pregnancies.
So, I mean, so it is sort of strange. I mean, a lot of people want to preserve abortion as kind of a last-ditch effort to terminate the pregnancy, but certainly there's a lot less radical, less painful ways to keep from getting pregnant. I mean, are you really encouraging women to get a lot of abortions? It's not really good for you, right?
I'm not encouraging.
Invasive procedure.
Well, see, but I think this is to look at it completely backwards. It's like, realistically speaking, I am all for promoting birth control. I mean, you know, there's just no one, you know, I would give, you know, free birth control to, you know, every lower income woman in this country, no problem. I mean, I just provide abortions. I think it's really unreasonable to expect the need for abortion to go away. I mean, that's my argument, that at some level, you know, there's some rate of abortion that's just, you know, the basic background rate given the human race being what it is.
Right. And so,
and it's probably like 5% of what it is in the United States, but, you know, still you're going to have that, you know, 5%.
So do you really think that it is indeed 5% that we're having, say, 20 times as many abortions as we should be?
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. I mean, people aren't, human beings ultimately aren't always sensible. They're not always logical, and we shouldn't try to, you know, imagine that they are. And so there is some unavoidable rate of people doing things. There's also contraception doesn't always work, too.
I see. Well, so in our few remaining minutes, I'd actually like to just to sort of go back to a previous topic, just for a moment, and I'm very interested in this, your, once again, your personal values about love and intimacy and sex and so on. So there was this high school student that you were telling me about, whom you met in the locker room.
Yeah,
and
I met him in the weight room, and I actually met him at I met him in the weight room first, or I saw him in the weight room. I should put this. I saw him in the weight room, and I didn't know he was a high school student at the time. He was in the pre-college program, mm-hmm. And I went to hear some band, and I was with my friend Eric Altman, and I said, you know, I think this guy's pretty hot, and he said something back, and I said, well, I bet I can meet him. And so what I did is I had a fork. Plastic fork, and I just threw it at him because he was looking the other way.
You threw a fork at him in where? Where was this?
This is just on the cut here.
Interesting.
And because there's just some band playing, and then I went over and got the fork and apologized for going over there.
Wow, and that actually worked. That you weren't. Was he amused by your fork throwing? Or?
Yeah. I started talking to him. I kind of knew it'd work.
So you began a sexual relationship with this high school student.
Not really sexual, but we started like seeing each other like every day and talking to each other, and we kind of talked about. I mean, I talked about how I found him attractive and this type of stuff, and then just before he left, he pulled me over toward him. He's pretty strong. He lifted weights a lot, and not that I would have resisted this. And he, cut his tongue down my throat, and he left.
So you actually kissed?
Yeah.
Did you realize? Wow. Did you turn this high school boy gay? I mean, are you responsible for that now?
I hope so. I don't know what his sexual orientation was. You know.
Oh my word. So I think, you know, I think that when you finally die, I think you have to donate your brain to science so we can finally understand what it is so powerfully seductive about you. I mean,
not much. I mean, I've had one sexual partner. I mean,
but Well, but presumably by choice, you appear to have this amazing ability to sort of attract and make friends with all kinds of random willing strangers, whereas I am universally defiled, or universally reviled, excuse me, by almost everyone.
Well, I think it's easy to feel like that, but I think a lot of people just want to meet people and they don't know how. Not to say I know how either, but...
Interesting. So we have what appears to be about a minute or so. I don't want to touch on that subject just really quickly. How, since we're on a campus where everyone is completely pathetically asocial, what are your top 10 tips for meeting a new person that you're interested in? Or let's make it top 2 tips. One appears to be throw a fork.
I think it's just to, you know, smile and kind of be genuine, that people like that.
I'd like to remind our listeners that this is WRCT Pittsburgh. So smile and be genuine.
Uh-huh.
And so the people that you meet, that you see for the first time, is there some kind of sexual desire? I mean, is that what you're attracted to them?
Yeah. I mean, well, and the thing is it really is like in these Rand novels. It's like, you know, like when I first saw Chris, I decided right then and there that I was going to have sex with him. I did. I very rarely have that feeling, you know.
Oh, that's incredible. Ayn Rand would completely approve, I think, of that kind of planning, if nothing else. Wow. Well, we have to go, I'm afraid, because we're out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us and sharing your controversial and fascinating opinions on all sorts of things. We hope to have you back again.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks to all of our listeners, and thanks to all the objectivists out there who are keeping the spirit of Ayn Rand alive, even if she's not corporally living anymore. Her work, her vision continues.
Rand bless you all.
And so thank you all for listening. Thank you, Michael, for joining us, and good night.